This is the Beat Your Genes podcast. My name is Nate G. I've created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle and Dr. Jen Hong, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle and Dr. Hawk analyze and explain the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during a show and ask a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751. Or you can send us a question through the website, www.beatyourgenes.org. All right. Good evening, everybody. It's Nate G here, along with Dr. Doug Lyle and Dr. Jen Hawk with the Beat Your Genes podcast. Dr. Lyle, Dr. Hawk, how are you guys doing this evening?
All good, Nathan.
Yeah, we're doing well. How's it going in L.A.?
L.A. is, I guess they're on lockdown for another few months. Orange County is starting to slowly open up. How's the lockdown going for both of you?
I don't know. Since I'm locked down, I don't pay any attention.
How are those acai bowls.
I keep getting acai bowls from Jamba Juice. Yeah.
As long as Jamba Juice remains solvent, then this is all just fine.
You know what? If Jamba Juice goes down because of this coronavirus, I'm going to be pretty irritated. I have to tell you that.
Well, it won't be because of your lack of support.
That's right. Oh my God! Well, I see that the apocalypse has not quite arrived yet because Starbucks is open.
Yeah, that's right. Starbucks opened most of its stores this week, which is a pretty big deal. So at least they opened to some degree, if not for dine-in traffic. They're at least semi-functional, and there have been many videos making their rounds around the internet that have shown like huge drive-through lines and obvious visual evidence that Starbucks is not going to fold anytime soon. So
well,
go America.
Despite not having any acai bowls.
They don't have acai bowls. Yeah, well, it's too healthy.
No, nothing like it.
Yeah. Starbucks doesn't want to serve anything healthy.
Well, I tried an acai. I don't have a Jamba Juice near me that has acai bowls, but I tried an acai shake, like a smoothie at the local vegan smoothie shop here. Dr. Lyle, they're pretty good. They're really delicious.
You can, if you get really desperate, make them at home,
Never.
You have to actually chop some fruit and open a frozen packet all by yourself, but it can be done.
Sounds like a lot of work.
Oh God. Well, I mean, then I got to work out for a few days in a row to get my muscles ready for that type of labor.
All you have to do is take a photo and post it on Instagram. That's the trade. You have to
what, and then an acai bowl shows up at my door if I do that?
Maybe.
Yeah.
This is the new rules of lockdown.
Yeah. All right.
Well, this goes into our first question of the evening. Oh, go ahead, Dr. Lyle.
Maybe later we'll do a little corona recap or something. Just thoughts about corona. They'll probably creep in. We don't need to do it now. Let's just go to questions.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So our very first question, dear doctors, do you all see any big long-term changes coming as a result of the shutdown and the isolation that will last more than a few months? For example, I think we might see a huge emergence of telemedicine and teleconferencing with less travel for face-to-face interactions. Question is, will this cause any long-term evolutionary pressures for habit change, or will we revert back to the same norms and status symbols?
I can jump in here. I think there's a couple of different questions there. The second question that's embedded in that big question, I think we can answer more easily, which is, will it cause any long-term evolutionary pressure for habit change? It's not going to change the species meaningfully. It's not going to change the way in which we allocate status or perceive status. All it has the potential to change if we do see permanent changes to the environment that we're operating in. It can change the cost-benefit analysis that we individually are running on maximizing our opportunities in the face of a new terrain, and that may move certain social equilibria in different directions. But that's not the same as an evolutionary change. So, and I think we're unlikely, although the question about, you know, what sort of long-term changes are we going to see, we're unlikely to see anything that is that significantly, like, the world has truly changed, we truly have a new normal. But I also think it's a little premature to say either way kind of what we're looking at there. We're definitely going to the observation of moving toward telemedicine and teleconferencing and sort of having big backup plans for remote events, that is going to be a big change that happens. And I anticipate, and I'd be interested to hear what Doug thinks about this too, but sort of a new equilibrium for general bureaucratic ass covering at every level, which is going to like the correct choice a lot of the time is going to become to move big events to remote if it's possible, or to cancel big sort of social events, and to essentially become more reactive to perceived threat if we see spikes in cases or new viruses emerging or anything that would sort of similarly alarm the masses. We've now established this new kind of baseline for freezing all operations and moving into lockdown mode. And I think there's going to be a tendency to want to do that if jobs and reputations are on the line. So I don't know about permanent changes, but I definitely think there's a change in expectations around big social gatherings, and people should be prepared for and moving toward a situation where they're embracing working remotely, working distance working, getting more flexible about all of that kind of stuff. That is very much the new reality, but things have been moving that direction for a long time. One of the most astute observations I saw on Twitter was, I think we may have talked about this last week or I mentioned it somewhere, but somebody said that their like 8 or 9 year old son said, you know, budding sociologist said that we're never going to have, school's never going to be canceled for a snow day again now that they have Zoom. It's like, yeah. Childhood is over. We're always plugged in now. Like, nobody gets a day off for a natural disaster because we get to move into this full-time connectedness, which comes at its own cost. So those are the main kind of patterns that I'm seeing. But I think it's really premature to sit here and try to, you know, prognosticate on what long-term changes we're going to see in society and how it's going to change the labor force profoundly. And we're only a couple of months in and we don't know how this thing is going to behave long-term or how long it's going to be with us or anything like that. So I don't want to be terribly irresponsible and just make some stuff up. But maybe Doug does.
Yeah, I don't mind.
I wonder when the status symbols of blinged out face masks.
That's going to be gone soon. Yeah.
Like the status symbols of what? Blinged out face masks.
Oh, blinged out face masks.
Oh, that's already happening.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
Humans.
Yeah, that's already very much like you're advertising your personality through your face covering. That's totally... I mean, I moved into that territory immediately. I'm like, if I have to wear this thing, I'm going to use it as an opportunity to advertise my big five to people. Of course I am. So I think you're going to see more of that as well.
It's kind of interesting to just speculate. And God knows someday we may listen to this podcast again and just see if we knew anything. In general, I would say that there's the reason why things have been done the way they've been done is for a whole complex constellation of obviously evolutionarily based motivations. And it's never made any sense to me. Not for a while. Why, you know, 1,000 people would get on an airplane and fly to Las Vegas and sit there and listen to some doctor drone on and on about how he thinks these are good stitches for the gallbladder that we're going to take out. And then they all have to write their big check for their continuing ed. And they have to sit there while they serve them a bunch of greasy food for lunch. And like, this is continuing education. This is like a complete total waste of time. And yet, the we do see that these kinds of things, conventions, etc., these are being driven by evolutionary pressures. It's a whole lot about sex. And so,
it's totally about sex.
Yeah,
it's
why
about the
go
receptions
to anything?
And the open bar and the hookups afterwards. Yeah, I was gonna say it's not about the sitting there and listening to the education or eating the greasy lunch. It's about what happens at the end of the day.
Yeah,
totally.
And the thing is that there is something to be said, I suppose, sometimes in creative processes for being in physical proximity to somebody, but usually not. The very same creative processes can take place by phone, by Skype, by, you know, anything like that. So the I think that we've just we see that there's an awful lot of quote waste and in the way people do things, but it's not wasted because it's actually being targeted at sexual motivation and sexual, i.e., status, etc. So my guess is that this is not going to change a lot of that. In other words, what do I really care when I really find out that, so if the coronavirus is in season, you know, 2 years from now, and that means that my risk as a 50-year-old, you know, guy is, you know, 1 in 18,000 that I could actually die from this thing. In other words, it's not as threatening as driving my car is. And so that's going to keep me away from some convention that I think is cool and where I had a cool hookup 2 years ago? No, I don't think so. So I think that human nature, you know, the reason why so much of the world, when it gets to a certain wealth level, looks very similar. In other words, the behavior in London and the behavior in Chicago and the behavior in New Zealand, it all looks pretty similar. And there's a reason why, and that's because the underlying human nature is so similar. And so I think, you know, people that are prognosticating about major changes in the way things will be done, no, I think you're going to see, you know, the creeping conveniences of doing things online. You know, these are coming and they've been coming anyway. However, some of the other things that you see are going to stay because this isn't going to scare them away. Some interesting things, you know, there are a lot of little, in other words, what I think you're going to see is parameter shifts. You're going to see little changes here, little changes there. I don't think it's going to be wholesale. If it was so financially intelligent to do it in a different way before and those overrode all other explanations or reasons, then it would have happened anyway. And the coronavirus is not going to be the tipping point in any major shift in human behavior. 9/11 wasn't. I mean, talk about capricious. You get on a plane, somebody flies it into the ground. It's like you could be 34 years old with your whole life in front of you, with your family with you. This isn't the coronavirus. The coronavirus is the median victim in the world for the coronavirus is over 80 years old. That's true for the United States as well. Okay, it's more true for the European countries. They have a little bit older populations than we do. So literally, the 50th percentile of the age of the person in the United States that dies from corona is at least 80. I mean, that's unbelievable when we realize the amount of time, attention, money, and sacrifice that is going on economically. We've now learned enough to know that, you know, what would be responsibly be done at this point would be high level and a lot of intelligence on how it is that we're going to manage our frail elderly people and see to it that when there's outbreaks that they would be reasonably protected as well as we can. But in terms of widespread protection of the population, this is absurd. Okay, and this reality will percolate its way down into not only how things will be handled in the near future, but absolutely how things are going to be handled in the long-term future. The long-term future, this level of threat to the average individual is so slight, it's so insignificant relative to all the other threats that their life faces, that that it's basically immaterial. And that will eventually be percolated down into all decisions. So that's how I see it. I do see, however, some things that Jen pointed out, are going to be, as she talked about, we've now found out what governments can do and will do in the face of threats. And as a result, that is going to establish some very important baselines for all kinds of things. So I, for example, if you're in business insurance, your industry just changed completely overnight. The financial vulnerabilities of all kinds of industries have been exposed in a way that nobody saw them coming. You know, Hawaii did not see anything like this coming. Like literally their entire economy is on its knees. Yeah, indefinitely. Okay, so, and you know, essentially subject to, you know, an entire culture as well as a lot of government decision making that essentially makes $1 trillion worth of hotel space worthless for the time being. So this is, you know, you got to wonder who is smart enough to put options in the stock market waiting for something like this. I'll bet one guy did, named Bill Gates, because he's been thinking about this kind of thing for a long time. So it wouldn't, he probably didn't do that, but he might have, Jen. that
if
guy
he
could
did,
have been.
I'm sure we'll see a documentary about it soon.
you didn't want it to happen, but I mean, you couldn't be Bill Gates and have been thinking about this at this level and not be prepared for it. So the I think
Gates Foundation, one of the favorite critiques of the conspiracy, the tinfoil hat conspiracy wearing types, is that the Gates Foundation did sponsor a pandemic preparedness exercise at Johns Hopkins in October they funded, and the hypothesized virus that they were sort of having their table discussion around was a coronavirus. Yeah. So there's a lot of conjecture that, you know, they part of why this was all planned, and they'll be embedding the chips and the vaccines in us anytime now. So
I tend to doubt
it was just
anything.
The most plausible scenario that was facing humanity. Right. That a lot of people were anticipating, that, you know, it was just a matter of time. It was not a question of right. if, but when something like this would emerge. And sure. that's also, like, you know, all of this we talk about, well, how has COVID-19 changed the game, and how are we going to continue to be trying to adapt social institutions and all of these things to it specifically? And that might be the wrong question, because they, you know, this is just, this is the pandemic that we're dealing with this year, but it is really just a matter of time until we're dealing with something else that, if not worse, is it goes through another period of great uncertainty, as this has, while we kind of sort out the case fatality rate and figure out what we're really dealing with. And now we've established this capacity to lock down and self-isolate. And so I think the tendency for bureaucrats and politicians and institutional leaders at universities and elsewhere to put that into motion before full information comes in is going to be very strong. So I think we should be anticipating that we're going to be ordered to shelter in place whenever we're facing any kind of moment of public health uncertainty, basically for the rest of our lives at this point, whether it's COVID-19 related specifically or not.
Goody.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
All right.
So stock up on your toilet paper now.
Oh, yeah, that's right. All right. What else we got, Nathan?
The same topic, dear doctors, this is a listener saying that I'm disagreeable and fairly low conscientious, and I don't respond well to authority. If I get told to do something I don't want to do, it just makes me not want to do it even more. During the pandemic, how can I stop getting annoyed and getting into arguments with people like supermarket workers, random idiots on the street who think I'm not walking fast enough to qualify as exercise, and other people making pointless and unreasonable demands beyond the legal requirements of social distancing? Sometimes it feels like some people are in a competition to be seen as doing the pandemic better than others, and they love to point out all the faults, real or imagined, of others.
This is well, like Nathan must have seeded this question for himself. Yeah. No, I smell a rat. No, I'm sure he didn't, but boy, it did. It sounds like a long lost cousin.
I promise it's not my question, but I can relate to some parts of this.
Yeah, go ahead, Jen.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's not the pandemic making you disagreeable and annoyed by everybody else. This is who you are as a personality. I mean, this is sort of just what we're dealing with. So the second part of the question, just to disaggregate it a little bit, like this, sometimes it feels like people are in a competition to be outperforming each other in their, you know, their compliant social distancing behavior, their community policing or whatever. That can be very true that is happening. That kind of virtue signaling is going on all over the place, and we've talked about that quite a bit on previous shows. But your annoyance with people criticizing you or making demands on you that you are uncomfortable with, or that are pushing you past the limits of your disagreeable thresholds, this is just a core disagreeable personality question. You're essentially asking how can you change your personality, and you can't. And you know, our stock advice is always you can't change your personality, so change your environment. But unfortunately for you, you can't really change your environment because we're in a quarantine. And so your options for reconstructing your social environment are definitely more limited right now than they normally would be. And you might be systematically more exposed to these things that frustrate you than you would normally choose to expose yourself to on a normal ongoing basis in your ideal utopian daily life. But, you know, welcome to planet Earth right now. Like, everybody is essentially being pushed to make those kinds of compromises and not, you know, I gave notice on my apartment in April because I was supposedly moving, but I, like, my new house is a flight away that I can't get. So I'm living in hotels until I can do that. And that's not, you know, not my ideal life equilibrium. And I definitely, even as an agreeable person, am hitting my frustration thresholds more often than I normally would because I'm in an environment that I didn't necessarily, it would not be my first choice for what I would put myself in. But this goes back to the kind of, you know, when you lose, don't lose the lesson kind of situation. Like, this is to some degree, we want to be sure that we're just kind of prepared for these kinds of eventualities as we go on and face more uncertain states of emergency where we might not have a lot of control over who we're living with or where we're living or who we're running into on a regular basis. And we lose all of the little rituals of daily life that buffer us and protect our personalities from these things. So you're a disagreeable person. Other people are annoying. Other people are always annoying, but they're more annoying if you're a disagreeable person. So I'm afraid there's really not much that we can tell you to do other than maybe invest in a better set of headphones and turn up your music when you're out and about and ignore people as much as possible, because you're not going to transform your internal emotional landscape, and you can't do much about the environment.
Yeah, and just have them drop the acai bowls on the front porch.
Yeah. That's true. And all of these apps, there's even like a little, you can put in the notes, you know, I don't want any contact. I want no contact delivery. So, you know, you don't even have to deal with the person's face, which is going to upset you, or the way that they're looking at you if you're not wearing your mask. So there are little tweaks where you can kind of control your environment. I just started watching this wonderful Netflix series called Afterlife with Ricky Gervais. Have either of you seen this or
no, huh?
Watched this at all? Oh, it's really great. I won't spoil it too much other than to say that the title character is a very typecast Ricky Gervais, who plays this quite disagreeable character who's had some difficulties in life recently and is just profoundly irritated by absolutely everything that he runs into on a daily basis. So, like, the guy eating chips across a different table is just, like, unbearable for him. And, you know, like, people, you know, smacking their gum too loudly or, you know, staring at him on the street or whatever it is. And he's just lashing out all the time. But it's clearly, this is the core of who this person is. And he's having a difficult time, and he's gone through some tough events in his life, and it all just seems it's all been turned up to 11 for him because it's just that much more raw. And that's what's going on with personality and with relationships and everything right now. Everybody's just a little bit on edge. So manage it as best as you can, but there's no mantra that we can give you to make the bad feelings go away.
All right. Grand, Nathan, what do we got next?
I was curious. Okay. So our next question, dealing with burnout. Dear doctors, I'm a hyper conscientious nutcase, as Dr. Lyle would say, and I've been running tech startups for over 25 years, but my latest one has really burned me out. My life and my office are in disarray. I'm normally a very organized person, but now I have piles of things everywhere and I can't seem to dig myself out. I can't get motivated. The only thing I'm very conscientious about now is my diet and exercise. Is there a way to kickstart my natural tendencies and get organized again? What do you suggest for recovering from burnout? And how long do you suppose it will take to recover?
Well, it's actually interesting because Jen just sort of explained, as we will do many times, that we don't change our personalities. And so this individual's personality is what it is. This is a very hardworking, super high conscientious, driven individual. And so as a result, what they're going through is inherently temporary. So it's a little bit like asking somebody or talking to somebody who's just been through the breakup of a major relationship and they're depressed and saying, well, you know, what can I do to snap out of it? And the answer is not much, because the truth of the matter is this is a natural reaction to loss. It's a natural reaction process. And so your mind has to go through a process where it sort of, you know, runs through the gamut of the Monday morning quarterbacking to try to figure out what went wrong, what could have been done differently, et cetera, and to put the entire experience in some kind of context. That's what the mind does. And so that's what's taking place here. Probably, you know, if they're hitting burnout now, there's a good chance that they worked extremely hard at the latest startup and something didn't go well. And so that may be what the burnout's about. It's probably that they didn't achieve a grand victory, which was the whole point of doing it in the first place. And so we probably got a sort of a hit to the whole perceived self-efficacy of the value of the effort in the first place. And so when you're, and remember to back the camera up and get it fine focused. Your feelings and your motivations are all derivatives of cost-benefit analysis of gene survival-related values. That's what they are. So as a result, when you're looking around at piles of crap and there's no money in those piles and there's no solution to a major problem in those piles, all there is getting rid of the residual fallout of messes that have to be cleaned up, then the CB just doesn't feel like it's worth it. And so what we're going to be hitting is we're going to be hitting some procrastination circuits that are going to be saying, you know what, I'm not so sure it's worth doing. Maybe if we just fiddle around long enough, we're not going to have to do it at all. So that's one part of the procrastination process that's going on in, quote, burnout. Another thing that goes on in burnout is that people are just literally physically tired, specifically with respect to sleep. And so that's why it's a good thing that this person is, you know, eating healthy and exercising, et cetera. So that's another part of the catch-up process of what burnout is. And another component of what burnout is, is that looking at the extent of the mess, you can feel that you don't have you don't have a lot of upside in its completion. So in other words, there's just not a lot of motive. There's not a lot of benefit relative to the perceived cost. And when you look at a big mess, a lot of times you also can have a sense that you might not be able to do it. And the reason is that you're thinking I might not be able to do it in a time frame that would be commensurate with it being valuable to do. So when you run a cost-benefit analysis, you're not just looking at the benefit, you're looking at the cost. and the cost is translatable into time and energy. So consider like looking at a big mess in your backyard, and you know the trees are overgrown, and you just bought this place, and you know there's a bunch of old furniture out there, and a compost pile that stinks at the back, and you know it looks like my yard. So you got this
bunch of acai bowls that are empty thrown in there.
So point is
with compostable forks.
You've got this you've got this mess, and you feel like sort of what you would be willing, the energy you would feel like you would be willing to put out to fix it. And then you sort of estimate that, you know what, that amount of time and energy isn't going to fix it. And so therefore, the essentially what you do is your mind runs a perceived self-efficacy judgment on how effective our actions are going to be in closing the distance between where we are now and where what the goal is that we're trying to attain. And it feels like, you know what, it doesn't feel like it's worth it because I don't think I can be as effective as I would need to be in order to make it worthwhile. So sometimes the true feeling of burnout is a feeling of overwhelm where there's so much crap when you look at that yard or when you look at that desk that you literally can't imagine that you could actually do it. It just feels like, no, it's actually just feels like it's beyond my abilities. That is a key thread of the process of burnout. And so one of the ways that this turns around is that when a person is either sufficiently rested or somehow a little parameter shifts somewhere and suddenly it's more motivating. and so something happens to mobilize a bit of energy. And when that happens and the person starts to work at it and they start to make progress, they find that essentially the internal audience watches the progress being made, can see it, and then that becomes part of a feedback mechanism that starts to then fire up the self-efficacy, and now we get an achievement cycle being stoked. We've all had this happen. So we've all looked at our messy living room or messy kitchen or whatever, felt overwhelmed, and just felt like, forget it, I don't even want to tackle it tonight. But then if we start moving on it and we start to see progress, then the internal audience starts to smile on us as it watches us make that progress. Usually if that progress is sufficiently feedback rich, it will fire up increased self-efficacy that it looks like we are making enough progress relative to the energy that it seems like it's worth it. And that will stoke an achievement motivation, it'll stoke an achievement cycle that will result in a cascade of motivation and then it all comes back. Okay, so that is a very typical process with respect to burnout. So one of the ways that I handle this clinically is, and I'll do this with myself, but I'll do this with clients. So let's suppose they've got a big mess like this person does. And so they look at that mess and I'll say, well, okay, how long do you think it's really going to take to get to the bottom of that mess and actually get it all organized? And they'll say like, oh my God, I don't know. I think it'd be like 6 or 8 weeks. And they don't even want to touch it. It doesn't feel to them like 6 or 8 weeks of that trade to get that done would actually be a benefit that was worth having relative to the cost. And they're not even sure they can do it because there's so many details involved that they are overwhelmed. And that feeling of overwhelmed, like I can't do this, is the low self-efficacy involved there is a major oppressive feature of what we call burnout. So now the solution is to, in your imagination, monkey around with the time horizons. So sometimes I will say to myself, if I looked at the messy backyard or anything else, or with a client like this, I'd say, okay, so do you think that you could actually clean up this mess if you took the next 2 years off and just saw that's all you did on it? And they'll laugh. They'll be like, well, of course. Okay, so now suddenly that feels, of course, doable. And you say, well, okay, well, what if you took like a year and a half? Could you do that? You know, it's 18 months. You think you'd clean it up? You'd be like, well, of course I can. That's not even close. Now, what's funny about that is if you start asking those questions, you'll start to fire up the self-efficacy that it can be done. because they'll realize, of course, that I can do that. That's plenty of time. They do have parameter estimates in their head about how long it would take to do this. And so then if you say, well, what about a year? Oh, yeah, of course. Okay. Well, what about 4 months? Yeah, I could do it in 4 months. Okay. So now they just couldn't do it in 60 days, which is kind of what they were planning and what they were realizing, it may not be worth it 60 days time. So if I tried to squeeze it into 60 days, could I do it? And the answer is maybe I couldn't do it. And therefore, if I can't do it in 60 days, my self-efficacy of pulling that off is low, and therefore I don't feel like doing it at all, and hell with the whole thing. Burnout. Okay? But if we actually consciously change the time horizons to make it very easy, then what happens is that the self-efficacy mechanism wakes up a little bit. And now it starts, the parameter estimation shifts. Therefore, the cost benefit starts to shift. The person starts to feel like they're not overwhelmed. Okay? So this is a way we try to slowly coax the system into action. And if it coaxes, it gets coaxed into action. Like, so for example, a person, you know, looking at their messy yard, and it's like, well, do you think you could, you know, looks like it's too much to clean up. It's like, well, could you clean it up if you had, you know, 4 weeks? Well, of course I could. Well, what about if you had 4 days? Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I could do it in 4 days, but I don't have 4 days. Okay. Well, how much do you, you know, why don't we see what you can get done in 4 hours? And the thing is if they start thinking along those lines and they start taking action, then what happens is this feedback-rich process starts to take place. And now we have a cascade of motivation. Okay, self-efficacy changes and it fires up an achievement cycle. So this is one of my long drawn out explanations to burnout. So burnout, it's worthy of discussion. It's a very good question because burnout is seen as some kind of bizarre, psychodynamically transmitted malaise without explanation. Okay, and that's not what it is. Burnout is not some special process. It lines up with all other life processes that has nothing other to do with basic motivational functions being derived from cost-benefit analysis, which are then being computed according to parameter estimates. So when a person feels burned out and is trying to figure out when is it, you know, when is it that I'm going to start and when am I going to snap out of it, the answer is going to be when your cost-benefit analytic engine gets new information. That's when you'll snap out of it, okay? And so that may be when you finally had enough sleep, or it may be when we have shifted time horizons, or some parameter in the stack of the mess has suddenly become far more worth doing, okay? So that's a long answer to a question about burnout.
That's wonderful, Dr. Lyle. Thank you.
This is you've just lived this, Nate. This is where you've been for the last. This is your parameter shifted in just the right way to get your act together.
Well, yeah, I mean, some of the silver linings of this lockdown was that my openness was held in check. And so I could organize things that I've just put off organizing for a long time. So, yeah, I mean, it started with a little thing, just looking at these whole boxes and saying, I got to do one little thing at a time, just like Dr. Lyle said. I actually had to go back and listen to some of the podcasts just to make sure I did it right.
Oh, my God. Okay. Fair enough. All right. We have time for any more?
Our next question. Yeah, we're at 37 minutes. It looks like 35 minutes. So maybe one more question.
All good.
Dear doctors, how do you help someone to get the right help? A colleague of mine recently opened up to me about struggling with what seems to be a deep depression and suicidal thoughts. She told me she has started a depth-oriented psychotherapy that is based on psychoanalysis and has started taking antidepressants, which seem to help a little bit. Having listened to all of your episodes, of course, I gave her a very light version of the Doug download on depression. I even told her about my friend with depression who had a single over-the-phone session with Dr. Lyle and already feels a lot better. But of course, anything I say is only a drop in the ocean. Knowing what I know about psychoanalysis, antidepressants, and the evolutionary psychology to explaining and treating, or rather helping someone understand and tackle the reasons of depression, this is really frustrating to me. How can you help someone get the right help? And what advice do I best give to someone who I know is on the right track, or is on the wrong track?
Well, I could speak to this, Jen, or whatever you want to, whatever you feel like doing.
Yeah, this is more a you question. You've addressed this kind of thing before, and especially because you there's a reference to a session with you here. So, but I think we'll probably wind around to the same sort of idea. So, take it away. Yeah.
Well, take a nap, Jen, because this might be another long one. No.
I've got, you know, busy. I've got things to do. I can just keep myself busy over here. My hotel lockdown. No. Take the dogs for a walk. I'll be back in about 15 minutes.
I would say the following, and that is that very often when it comes to making a changing direction on a decision, there has to be sufficient motivation to do so. So this individual is getting, the patient there is getting reassured by professionals that they are doing the right thing and that they have, you know, some fancy stuff in the drawer that is, this is the way this takes place. This is how it's going to be fixed. So it's your credibility against the professional's credibility. They're heavily incentivized. They also believe in what it is that they're doing. And they don't have anything else to do. And they're pretty damn sure that there isn't anything else other than psychodynamic analytic depth therapy plus drugs. That's what they think it is. They think that's that is the status quo. That's the legally defensible way of doing things. You could do CBT as well if you wanted to, you know, but this is like the person is doing what they're being told is this highly responsible thing. You did something very smart, which is to give them a light version about saying, hey, listen, there's an alternative view of being depressed, that this is an adaptive mechanism. It's a natural consequence of negative feedback. And so the way to approach this is to maybe look at to see how to be more successful in getting better feedback, then we'll feel better. Very reasonable, obviously. But not necessarily sufficiently motivating. It isn't clear enough how that would work. It's a nice talk, but there doesn't seem to be any necessarily walk with it. And if there was, then certainly these other geniuses would have figured it out. So therefore, it's reasonable that the person doesn't think that you have anything useful for them. Fair enough. Okay. So they've got time, we would hope. We would hope that they don't take their own lives partly as a result of ineffective intervention. And so they probably won't. So they've got time to mess it up, time to suffer, time to maybe let spontaneous fixes that take place in their own life as their own natural motivation continues to seek solutions to the problems, and they may eventually get some partial or decent solutions, and they may resolve the depression and then just have to put up with the fact that they're getting little midget brain disruption on their quote medication that they quote need. So there's nothing about the path that they're on that is doomed to fail at all. It's not likely to be as effective and as efficient and clean and healthy and potentially long-lasting and useful as they might if they would become educated about how their own mind works and then figure out what levers to pull that they have their own personal options on that they're in control of in order to better their lives. So they may not get lucky and hit the, you know, pull the right lever. It's okay. Okay. There's time also for them in the future. So no rush. This is, you know, sometimes I'll deal with parents that are very, very frustrated about their late teens, early 20s children that are kind of messing up, or maybe they're mid-teenagers, and they're very worried about them because this or that is happening not optimally. And my response is, relax, okay? No reason to panic. The couple things I'm worried about drug addiction and pregnancy. Beyond that, I'm really not worried about much of anything. And So when they make sort of lousy choices, they should have made this friend instead of that friend, or they should have had this job instead of that job, or they need to get off their rear end and do something productive, or if they would just study harder, they get better grades, so we could get a better school. All of that is irrelevant to me. I consider that unimportant, because the truth is there's plenty of time. Plenty of time for people to learn lessons, plenty of time for them to correct poor strategies that they've been using, and that's fine. And so there's plenty of time for this person. So be patient and no worries, and they will go along and they may be fine. And you may see 4 months from now that they're pretty comfortable with where they're at, and then we did what we did, which is to whisper in their ear. Now, a few months from now, they're still really struggling and they don't look like they're doing well. We whisper in their ear again. The second time you whisper in their ear, they're a slightly more interested than they were the first time, because now they've had a bunch of failure. Okay, they're still suffering. And we aren't swearing up and down to them that we've got the solution of the universe here, but it might be interesting. It might be worth looking into. And so I would send them to our website. Just say, well, you might want to just take a look at the Steam Dynamics website. It's interesting. Okay. And so who knows, might be helpful, might not be helpful. Who the heck knows? I just think it's interesting. And that's how we talk to people about anything, whether it's dietary change, whether it's, a good book that we think would be great for them, or whether or not it's STEAM processes and evolutionary psychology. It's interesting. Might be useful. Who knows? Might want to look at it. Nice, soft sell, gentle. We don't steamroll, and we don't insist, and we don't guarantee. We don't do anything. Just lead the horse to water. If they're not ready to drink, they might be in the future. That's how we do it.
Wonderful. Dr. Hawk, what say you?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I think you have to let the source code of evolutionary psychology speak for itself. It's people are either going to be either recognize the truth of their situation when they are exposed to it, or they're not. And it's not something that most people sort of need to be convinced into. There's sort of a resonance or there's not. And that resonance is a function of a lot of things. It's sort of general life circumstances. It's the cost benefit on their relationship with their other therapist and what they're getting out of that relationship, which might be a lot, a lot of maintenance of enlightenment traps and competitive avoidance that they are hoping to continue to sustain and have an endorsement of. There might be some personality factors at work. There could be some distortions in education going on. That was the case for me, where I was resistant to some of these principles for a long time. Even though I was sort of exposed to them, I preferred to pursue my own therapeutic relationships in sort of a more psychodynamic space, because I was misinformed about some of the science and the explanatory power of evolutionary psychology. So people just kind of go on their own path with this stuff. And when it's the right fit for the kinds of problems that they're facing, and they come across the information in the right moment and it resonates, then they will drink the water that they have been led to. But you can't force it down anybody's throat. Just like this is very akin to, we're always getting questions that are similar to this about dietary advice. How can I share the great advice that I found about a whole food plant-based diet with my friend or my family member who's struggling with some disease process or some health issue? And it's exactly the same process. All you can do is expose them to the information, kind of, dribble it out. This is kind of interesting. You might want to check this out. Here's a documentary. This is, might be worth looking into. And remain in that space for them if they decide to tentatively approach you again with the same question. But the more you push this kind of thing, whether it's dietary advice or advice about what kind of psychology to integrate into your problem solving, then you're tapping into innate status rooted resistance mechanisms. So you never want to be doing that. You just want to be the keeper of the wisdom should they come looking for it.
Beautiful.
Wonderful. Now, Dr. Ladd, Dr. Hawk, maybe you can correct some of my thinking. Is It sounds like if someone's in this position, they are trying to earn esteem from the friend they are trying to give advice to. So do you believe it may be helpful for the person trying to earn the esteem to try to earn it in a different way rather than trying to beat the drum on you know, esteem dynamics or whole food plant-based diet or whatever it is?
When we talk about this, we talk about people sort of having the teaching gene or the impulse to share valuable information with the village. And so if you ever find yourself in a situation where you're sort of feeling upset, you're feeling an emotional response to somebody not taking your advice, that's a, I don't necessarily get that from this question, but if that is the case, that's a little signal to you that you've got some status invested in the, or a bid for status directed in the wrong place, because that you're asking them to make themselves inferior to your to the wisdom that you are offering them. You're basically demanding that they lower your status relative to yours, and that's not usually a comfortable request of that anyone is going to make of you. So if it's generating that little charge where you're like, why won't you take my really good advice? Like, I'm like, I know it's best for you. You know, just step back from that. That's not something that you want to be doing. It's not seeking esteem in the right ways from the right people in the way that it matters. So yeah, go seek a different path.
Extremely tempting. Yeah, it's beautifully said.
Totally.
But it is extremely tempting. And so if ever there was a time to be thinking, beat your genes, it's there. Because you're basically like a barracuda, you know, gonna hit a shiny thing in the water. And so we need to exactly as Jen says, that's where we need to back up. If we feel really acute frustration, that's a sign that our very natural instincts have taken on a little too much steam behind this, and it's time to just, you know, dust it off and back off a little bit.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Thank you, Dr. Lyle. Thank you, Dr. Hawk, very much for the show. And I know we've got, you wanted to give us an update with some stats, so let's do that show.
Let's do next show. Besides, that way, the stats will be more accurate because I'll have more time to collect them. All right. All good.
Wonderful. Have a good night, Dr. Lyle, Dr. Hawk. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you, Nathan.
All right. Talk to you soon, Nate. Have a good one.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G., Dr. Lyle, and Dr. Hawk with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.